Welcome back to another episode of the Damage Report. I'm John Iadarola. Very special in studio guest today. It's not often that I can say this, but Emma Vigeland is here.
Oh, it's so good to be here. So good to
How's
see
it going?
Everyone. It's going great. We're gonna act like we didn't chat before the show.
Exactly. I don't know who you are.
Yeah.
And so just in case anyone else doesn't, where can your work normally be found? What do you normally focus on?
YouTube. Oh, what I normally focus on, I guess I do a lot of candidate interviews. Wow, I'm already about
Recently
this.
You've done a lot.
Yeah, I've done some. I was at the New Hampshire Democratic Convention this weekend, so I was able to actually get into the press gaggle and ask candidates hard questions where everyone just wants to talk about their debate strategy and is it going to change now that it's 10 people on the stage and only one night? and I like to talk about policy, so that was one thing that I did, but I also talked to supporters of all the different candidates to get where they stand, from anyone to Trump supporters, which I think I'm most known for, but also Amy Klobuchar supporters I spoke to recently. Mm-hmm. So you can find that on youtube.com/rebelHQ and facebook.com/rebelHQ.
Yes, as you alluded to, you're perhaps best known for embedding yourself in Trump rallies and doing a very good job of not alerting people to what you really believe so that you can get their authentic answers about a number of different topics.
I think that there can be this like inclination to just get in people's faces and be aggressive with them because you want, you know, it's satisfying, but I don't think it yields the best journalistic results. So I'm gonna sit here on my high horse and talk down to other people now.
Okay. Yep. And right now we're sitting on very high chairs and we're gonna do our best to uphold journalistic ethics as we go through a number of different awesome topics. So we're gonna be starting off with an update on the Bahamas, the damage that was done by Hurricane Dorian. Very soon, actually, in just about 10 minutes or so, we're gonna have a congressional candidate in studio for an interview. He is in a primary to possibly challenge Devin Nunes. So very important race there, but other topics as well. We're gonna be talking about what I fear might be the next phase of the 2016 superdelegate debacle, where you get this sort of false sense of where the primary is going with information that we don't actually have. I'll give you all the details on that later. Also, gun control, are we going to see some action now that the House is back in session? We'll talk about that. And Donald Trump versus Fox News, the latest in that. His fans are now getting in on the fun, so that should be a lot of fun. That's how we're gonna close out the show a little bit later on. But we'll start off with an update on the hurricane. Hurricane Dorian is just days past or so, but the damage is still being assessed, especially in the Bahamas. It was hit incredibly hard by that storm. The work of assessing the damage from Hurricane Dorian is apparently so arduous that the Bahamian government is so overwhelmed that a full accounting of the missing and dead may not be known for weeks or even months. We sort of expect that we'll instantly know what actually happened there, but we don't yet. The official death toll is at 44 right now, a significant number, but there's no estimate yet of how many people are unaccounted for. Security forces are still responding to reports of missing and trapped people, and teams of forensic investigators are still combing through the storm debris. And so because the US wasn't hit as hard as many feared, in Florida, Alabama dodged a bullet there. I think the inclination is to think, oh, it wasn't so bad. And yet there are still people like waiting to be rescued. And so I don't want us to forget about what's going on in the Bahamas right now as well.
Yeah, of course, but the Trump administration isn't going to take the Bahamian plight seriously. This is the kind of administration who didn't even want to help Puerto Rico, which is a significant part of the United States. I mean, we have, the Bahamas is not, but Puerto Rico is, and Trump still did not want to help people. Now he's basically saying that he doesn't want to let Bahamian people into the United States. He's consistently showing that he doesn't care about people if they're black or brown and they're hit by these hurricanes and these natural disasters. And he's also not addressing the root of the problem, which is climate change and continuing to run rampant over it. So it's disturbing no matter which way you look at it.
Yeah, and we're gonna have some video of Trump talking about this just a little bit later on. But I was reading a New York Times article about the continuing search for survivors of the hurricane. And there was a section that was just devastating that I want to read. This is from McAdrian Farrington, who said, listen, it's been a week. He lost his 5-year-old son and namesake when the floodwaters rose in Murphytown, just west of Marsh Harbor. After he put the boy on the roof for safety, he says bodies are decomposing day by day. His child's body has not been found. And like, just think about how devastating that is. That like, there's no reason why literally anyone had to die in the hurricane. We have the resources to protect these people, to save these people, but let alone that almost a week would go by and you just want some sense of closure to recover the physical remains of your child who died so needlessly. Like that is just, Like, I've been thinking about having kids recently, and like the idea of being in that position is just so hard to even imagine. And to know that, you know, hundreds, thousands of people are in that position. They've lost someone that they love, or they're worried that they will. Someone's missing, they don't know where they are. And it's taking so long to actually find out.
And the New York Times did great work here by describing the corpses, the bodies, they're just laying around in the open in these areas. And that when you're in these communities that are unable to kind of have the resources to count the dead, the toll is way higher than the 4,450 that we're gonna be seeing. And it's just gonna climb up and climb up and climb up. And this is what the natural consequence of climate change is. These increasing storms that are gonna hit communities that have the resources, do not have the resources to address them in the same way that the wealthy coastal communities in the United States would, or in other countries. And and those are the people whose children will die, whose 5-year-olds will die, and they won't be able to find those bodies.
Yeah, and like when I see that the official count is at 44, I remember the official count with Hurricane Maria was like 61, 69 or something, and thousands of people died in the aftermath of it. And like the same sort of situation could happen here. Medical facilities have been destroyed, infrastructure destroyed, the ability to get, you know, access to clean water destroyed. And so many people theoretically could die in the next few weeks, the next few months, because of the hurricane, but not close enough to the hurricane to actually be included in the official count. And so we might have a false sense of, well, it was bad, but it wasn't that bad. But was it? Hurricane Maria was devastating. It was worse than 9/11 in terms of sheer body count. And yet, do we talk about it in those terms? Did we rally trillions of dollars to deal with the threat in the same way that we did with 9/11? Not even remotely.
Well, there aren't brown people and there isn't one boogeyman that is able to be blamed for that. So that's really what happens. And when it's a natural disaster, it can be seen as something that's entirely out of our control when, as I've repeated throughout this segment, it's within our control. The intensity of these storms are a direct result of what we're doing day to day on the ground, what our government's inaction is causing. And there is a human cost that is gonna be enormous.
Yeah, and it is possible that other storms will hit the Bahamas soon. There's a tropical wave with the possibility of becoming Tropical Storm Umberto. As Florida in its trajectory, it's already about to descend on the Bahamas, according to the National Hurricane Center. There are several tropical waves that exist with the potential to develop tropical maturity over the next 5 days. And so, I mean, just briefly, so you mentioned climate change. Like when we talk about like how climate change is affecting like ocean levels and things like that, some incredibly simplistic people, including Senator Ted Cruz, think that that's the threat then, that eventually the water will be so high that the island will be underwater. That is not the only threat. I mean, not only is there the increase in severity of storms, the increase of prevalence of storms, that they're becoming far more common, but also when the storms hit, because the ocean is higher, even though it is not at a level where it's already flooding the area, storm surges become far more significant. So decades before Florida is literally underwater, they're going to be hit by far worse storms because the storm surge will just naturally year by year be getting worse and worse. So we do have to worry about Miami being flooded, but long in advance of that, they're gonna be suffering the damage of climate change, the damage that we're taking so unseriously as of right now.
Not on the damage report.
No, we do take it, yeah, we take it seriously.
Sorry.
Here, thankfully.
Just a little lightening of the mood there.
Yeah, so why don't we turn to someone who's not taking this seriously. Donald Trump was asked recently at Chopper Talk about the Bahamas and the plight of the people there. And I wanna give you an idea of how seriously he takes it. And as we've been alluding to, based on the nature of the people there in this clip.
You know, we're recovering from the hurricane also. Florida did get hit, not as hard as we anticipated. And you look at Georgia, you look at South Carolina, North Carolina. We have to be very careful. Everybody needs totally proper documentation because the Bahamas had some tremendous problems with people going to the Bahamas that weren't supposed to be there. I don't want to allow people that weren't supposed to be in the Bahamas to come in to the United States, including some very bad people and some very bad gang members and some very, very bad drug dealers. So we are going to be very, very strong in that. Let me just explain. Large sections, believe it or not, of the Bahamas were not hit. And what we're doing is bringing the people to those sections of the Bahamas that have not been hit.
So in less than a minute, he said three awful things. So awful. One is, hey, we were hit too, even though Florida did much better than it was expected. So who cares what happens to them? You know, my mom lives on Pompano Beach, like it's right in the hurricane lane, and they're fine, okay? They'll recover. I think they have to replace their dock. Okay, they're gonna be okay. They're not dying in the streets. Second, we need extreme vetting because these people are all terrible gang members and criminals.
Drug dealers. I know.
I wonder why that's what his response is in this particular case. And then what was the third? Oh, large sections haven't been hit. Okay, those areas don't need as much help. Okay, but the places that were hit do need help. People are dying right now.
They need documentation before he even said the drug dealers things. That we need significant documentation for them because there are a lot of bad people coming into there. Well, you need documentation to basically house people in the Bahamas who are our North American neighbors, yeah, while after they've been hit so significantly by this natural disaster. And you know, I'm sure Donald Trump has had no problem going to the Bahamas and areas like that for vacations and for golfing and for all of these hoity-toity events. But when it actually comes down to helping the people who live there, who are the offset of the profit and the rampant capitalism that he espouses, then no. They're drug dealers, they're criminals, he's gonna take another step further and call them rapists too.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah, they're our neighbors. We have the resources to help them. Like, when there are problems in the world that theoretically people in the military-industrial complex think can be solved by bombing them, any amount of resources is fine. But if building something back up is the solution, not so much interest. Like, we have all this wealth, all this power, all this influence, the ability to extend our power around the world, and we'll do it under certain circumstances, but especially under Donald Trump, although historically too, this sort of thing, they're not our people. And even if they were our people, if it was Puerto Rico, do we really care? It's not Texas. I mean, come on, do they really need our help? It's just, that was just the response of some racist you talk to in a bar. Like, yep, they're probably criminals, they're probably drug dealers. Let them die. Honestly, who cares? That's what you get from our president.
Lack of empathy is not even putting it too harshly.
Exactly.
It's disgusting.
Yes. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back. Canada is gonna be joining us in studio after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
In the last cycle, the midterm elections, Devin Nunes, Republican congressman, has become pretty notorious for some of his actions in office, just narrowly fended off a Democratic challenger. About 5 points he won by in a district that had been considered more Republican than that in the past. So he survived in 2018, but perhaps not in 2020. There's a contested Democratic primary to choose a challenger to take on Devin Nunes. And we're joined now in studio by one of those candidates, Dari Rezvani. Welcome to the studio.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here. So I'd like to get to know you and your district a little bit as well. So what's your background before running?
So a little bit about me. I'm a small business owner in Fresno. I started an automotive repair business when I was 19 with my father. Oh, wow. I ended up taking full responsibility of it after he passed away from stage 4 lung cancer. During that time, I put myself through community college and ended up getting a degree in accounting from Fresno State, subsequently joining PricewaterhouseCooper and working as a management consultant there. And ultimately could not sit still as I watched the country I love fall apart. I remember I was working in Texas and the seventh or eighth child had died in the detention centers, and it kind of puts things into perspective because I had a great life, but what good is that if, you know, the country is falling apart and, you know, you can live in your little siloed bubble, but that doesn't mean things are going well. It just means things are going well for you. And ultimately, you can't turn on anything with seeing how abysmal the situation that we are in the United States. And so I felt that I had to do something. After seeing how close Andrew Jantz had come in 2018 and no one had challenged, no one had stepped up at that point to challenge Nunes, I decided to throw my hat in the ring. It's kind of one of those situations, if not me, who, and if not now, when. Yeah. So I did it.
Okay, so you mentioned the world falling apart. That's sort of the theme of the show. Yeah. I agree. What are the particular parts, the ways that it's falling apart that you want to focus on? Like we'll get to Devin Nunes, but in your primary battle, how are you going to differentiate yourself? What are the issues you're going to focus on?
So I'll say there's four things. The first, everyone's focusing on immigration reform. I mean, the things that are happening at the southern border are absolutely abysmal. The difference is, everyone is just saying it's bad. What are we going to do, right? My answer to that is we need to allocate more resources to judges and administration. We need these asylum seekers to actually be given their due process as opposed to just being packed into cages like sardines. The next thing being climate change, environmental justice specifically. I actually am doing a video next month with Keyshawn White, the Clean Air Project in Fresno, that highlights the exact injustices that are happening. You know, we put our factories in low-income areas, and because of that, the air quality is about four times worse in Fresno in the southwest part of it. And because of that, we have a higher asthma rate in that area. And then we have, you know, Medicare for all. I mean, we have a broken healthcare system. My father, as I mentioned, passed away from lung cancer, and it wasn't even 24 hours until I got the first bill collectors calling for his medical expenses.
Yeah.
We're the richest country in the world. I think we can do a little bit better than that.
Yeah.
And then lastly, student loans. Look, I'm the youngest candidate that's running in this race right now, and the fact is we have, what, 44 million Americans with student loan debt, $400 a month is the average payment. You know, forgiving that, that stimulates the economy with about $17 billion annually. It, you know, the three largest student loan companies only hire about 18,000 people. You know, I'm no mathematician, but 44 million over 16,000 or 18,000 seems like it's beneficial for the United States as a whole. And so those are the issues that I'm focusing on specifically because I'm trying to get people to actually vote. You know, in the last election, a lot of it was focused on not being Devin Nunes. And I see that being a theme of some of the other Democratic candidates. We saw it in 2016, not being the other guy just doesn't work. You know, at a certain point, you have to get people out to vote. And specifically in District 22, we have a lot of impoverished areas that these smaller farm towns of 5 to 15,000 people, they don't really care if you're a Democrat or Republican. You're not listening to them.
Yeah.
You know, and so you have to meet people where they are and actually give them a reason to come out and vote.
Well, let's talk about the other guy, though, because I am curious about Devin Nunes. He's been an extremely visible Republican when it comes to the national stage. But in the district, how visible has he been, and what is the kind of general consensus around him as a representative?
So there is a lot of discontent with him, particularly around the issue of water. I think he picked it up a little bit because Jantz came so close. I believe there were about five or six bills that all of a sudden got streamlined through when things got a little bit tighter. But ultimately, you know, he just dropped the lawsuit, but he was suing four of our constituents for trying to change his designation on the ballot, and two of which I consider pretty close friends. One's a librarian, you know. I mean, as someone who is a representative of the United States, to be doing these kind of pedantic, childish, sophomoric actions. He has no place in the government, and regardless of Republican or Democrat, he's an embarrassment to our community.
Yeah. I don't know, childish, sophomoric action seems pretty in vogue in the US government right now. Yeah, take a look at our weather maps. So I did want to ask you, we're very interested here in primary challenges and how the Democratic establishment deals with certain candidates. So one of your opponents, Phil Orballo has said that he's been in contact with the DCCC. Yeah. Have you been contacted by either the DCCC, the DNC, any organization?
I had preliminary discussions when I first started the run. Hello, this is who I am. But other than that, we have not really been in communication. I'm trying to win a race. So, okay.
So not talking to the DCCC is the way to go?
Well, I don't know about that, but I know that talking to my constituents is a lot more important than talking to the establishment. So,
and sort of related to that, it's one of the things they get involved in. In terms of financing your campaign, what's your philosophy?
It's got to be grassroots. I'm not afraid of taking large dollar donations, but they can't have stipulations tied to them. Mm-hmm. Luckily, there is a large Middle Eastern community in the district, and I'm very close with them. So that has been a steady stream helping me out. But ultimately, you know, I don't have very popular issues when it comes to people with the money, right? Mm-hmm. You know, when I'm not exactly the guy that can sit in these high dollar fundraisers and say, we need to tax people more, and then all of a sudden get big checks, right? Mm-hmm. So my philosophy is I call people 6 to 8 hours a day. Hopefully that works. I got a pretty strong digital fundraising team that's helping. And, you know, hopefully the people watching this can help out a little bit too.
Where can they go to find out more about you?
Dary for Congress, DaryFor, congress.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, I appreciate you for having me. Thank you
very much.
Yeah. We're going to take a short break. We come back, lots more to get to. Okay, I can't tell you how many times throughout this race so far, the primary race in 2020, we've said that it is a long time until anyone actually votes. And although we pay attention to the polls, we care about the polls here, nobody knows how this thing is going to go. But that might not be the impression you get if you're watching TV now, because I have seen the beginnings of what looks like an attempt to sort of give a sense of inevitability to this thing, to imply that we know more about how it's gonna go than we actually do. This is coming from CBS News, not CNN or MSNBC, oddly. And I wanna show you a couple of clips to give you an idea of what might become a trend, at least that's what I fear. Here's the first.
There is big news in our CBS News Battleground Tracker. That's our survey of the Democratic candidates and how they're doing in the early contest. There are 18 states in our aggregate, starting with the Iowa caucus up through Super Tuesday. And there is a big reshuffling in the top tier. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren is now at 26% support, just ahead of former Vice President Joe Biden at 25%. The third candidate in our top tier is Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. He has 19% support.
Okay, now what you just saw, that's not the most egregious thing. We're gonna have one more clip that's worse, but I wanna explain that, because what you saw there is not a poll. It is an aggregation of polls to create an idea of, over the course of months of elections, through which many things will change, there'll be debates, all of that stuff, we have an idea of the overall result that will happen. And so in all of these early, Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, all of these, Warren's at 26 now, and Biden's at 25.
And it's not even how those states work. So they're aggregating all different states with all different counting processes, caucuses, primaries. Mm-hmm. So the methodology is shoddy, to say the least, and it's just to create this entire horse race dynamic where they're getting viewers engaged on who's winning, who's
she's up,
who's
now.
Down. She's up, it's NFL red zone, except for freaking like the politics. So it's just really a reality show to a lot of these hosts.
Yeah.
And that's what's annoying about the journalism there. Like, just spend your energy doing anything else, mm-hmm. really anything else. And then you'll be good.
Yeah, and look, like I said, there are a lot of polls that are useful. I'm gonna have one for you that CBS News put out that I think is interesting that we can learn something about. But this like attempt to take like a 4 month chunk of this thing and then say, we have a number that comes out of all of that. I mean, come on, like how serious are you actually being? But like I said, that's not the most egregious thing, because at least that is just a poll, right? Or it looks like the results of a poll. But they go farther than that. Take a look at this.
By the time you get through all of those states, Joe Biden is doing well enough. He's racking up a lot of delegates, a lot of votes in places like South Carolina, that he still has the overall delegate lead in that estimate when we take these vote preferences and we translate them into how the delegates would be awarded in the states.
So that's important still to actually clinching the nomination.
Yeah, by the time when you get to next summer and you're at the convention, right, the balloons drop, that's how the delegates are actually awarded to candidates.
So that's how many delegates they have in the estimate. There are no delegates. No delegates have voted. They're months and months and months away from voting. So all that is let's take the percentage we say they'll get and then map that to delegates and then put up a graphic that looks suspiciously like the old superdelegate projections from 2016.
Even with the superdelegates not being in the first round, the mainstream media is still trying to find a way to give Joe Biden, who was leading in that delegate count there, the inevitable delegate victory, or make it seem like Bernie Sanders' delegate lead is insurmountable, when we all know that how Iowa allocates its delegates, how New Hampshire does it, how Nevada does it, how South Carolina does it, it's all different and it's all fluid. This is not static. It's changing all of the time. Yeah. And it is comical to put that on the screen and say that it's any kind of journalism here, because it's just rampant speculation. And say, if you want to say, oh, this is my prediction, like if you want to pull a Jank and do a prediction on TV, that's fine. Say it's a prediction, but they're acting as if it's some sort of empirical data, and it's like this Nate Silver crunching of the numbers, when it's actually just throwing a dart at a wall.
Yeah.
You're with a blindfold on.
Yeah, it's less Nate Silver crunching the numbers and more Nate Silver tweeting whatever the hell he wants on Twitter. Like, you know what? I have this number, and sure, it looks like Bernie's doing okay, but don't like him. He's gonna lose. That's what it feels like. And like, if you're in an airport or a gym and you see that graphic flashed up on the screen that shows, oh my God, Biden's got 600 delegates already? The election's still months and months away. He's leading. No, he's not. They use the word estimate again, like you said, as if it's empirical. It's not. This is just guesswork, which you can present it as that, but it's not what you're saying. And it's even worse in their writing, because look at the way they describe this. This is from CBS News. The former vice president now clings to a narrow lead over Warren in our CBS News YouGov tracker estimate of convention delegates, the only count that ultimately matters. This is what matters. He has an estimated 600 to her 545. She's gained delegate share as supporters of other lower tier candidates have been switching their preferences towards her. No. She's been gaining in the polls as that's been happening. There is no delegate share. That's not a thing. It isn't anything. It is just a thing that makes it seem as if we know more than we do. And look, I like pretending to have knowledge I don't, but you need to be responsible when you're on TV.
And you know how the delegates shift? Because the polls are reflective of the votes, which then the delegates reflect later. So it doesn't make any sense to be estimating delegates after the polling. Polling is fine. I already think that we put too much stock in the polling and there's too much on, you know, CNN, CBS, all the mainstream media, like, ooh, look who's up, who's down. But going a step further, it's irresponsible.
Yeah, it's incredibly irresponsible. I'm gonna jump one graphic ahead. I wanna show you a graphic. Again, imagine you're really busy, you flip on the TV and you see this graphic. So that looks like, oh my God, my state already voted. California's done and Biden is rocking this thing. Like, man, Klobuchar might as well drop out. You've only got 13 delegates. No, no, she should drop out, but not for that reason.
Yeah.
And look, the word estimate is technically there, but if you saw that, you'd think, oh, like half the states have already voted. This thing is locked down. And I don't know if in a couple of months, they're gonna start reporting superdelegate estimates as well. They might still do that, even though the superdelegates are not voting in the first round. And the superdelegates have literally never actually, in the way that they're intended to, influence the system. Only by projection have they done that. That should not happen this time. It might still happen, but even if it doesn't, if this sort of thing spreads, if suddenly MSNBC and CNN are like, oh, we can just do these estimates and it looks like we know what we're talking about, then what's the difference if we got rid of the superdelegates? If this gives this false sense of inevitability, like by the time all of those states will have voted, we will have polls change as a result of earlier votes. We'll have polls change as a result of the 13 to 17 debates that are gonna happen between now and then. How can you possibly imply that we know what's gonna happen on Super Tuesday when Iowa hasn't even voted yet? But there is something to be said for polls. And that's why, like, you can report on polls. I like polls. I used to work on polls, actually. So look, if you wanna show this poll, for instance, here is an interesting thing showing month by month, one thing. What do people think about Elizabeth Warren in a race against Trump? Can she win? The electability argument. And you can see that from June to now, it's gone up. You can look at that and learn something. That is not odd and irrational and arrogant to show that. But when you try to imply, oh, and so because she's at 55% now, I'm gonna give her X number of, what are you talking about?
That's no, it's a so data point. These are all data points, but if that's not profitable, you have to make it seem like it's bigger than it is. You have to differentiate yourself, these giant mega corporation journalist organizations think that from this news organization, we have some secret knowledge. We have, you know, what's it, the scroll, the, just, I don't know why I'm
trying
to make
Harry Potter? I don't know. It's the Philosopher's Stone is what you're talking about.
Right, right. I think so too. The Sorcerer's Stone. Exactly. Please, we're American. Oh, by God.
But that's what I've read.
Yeah, so no, I completely agree with you wholeheartedly. And the fact that we're pretending like there's any credence to this is absurd.
Exactly. Okay, but we'll see if they continue. Hopefully, if we attack them enough, they won't.
We'll see if they continue. We know they're going to continue.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a short break. We come back. Gun control. Will it happen after this? If you believe that we're long overdue for significant gun control, you're probably feeling pretty good right now if you just listen to what politicians are saying, because pretty much everybody is implying that now that Congress is back in session, it's finally gonna happen. The White House is supposed to put out their gun policy proposals this week. Even Mitch McConnell may be interested in doing something, and the Democrats are coming in guns blazing, I guess is the expression, to do something. And in fact, they just released a new PSA through the Giffords Courage to Fight Gun Violence organization. Let's take a look.
Gun violence is literally life and death.
That has become so numbingly common
that we have kids going to school wondering if they're going to be physically safe.
Learning about how to duck, cover, hide.
For fear that there is a mass shooter roaming the hallways of their school.
That's wrong. That shouldn't happen in a country like ours.
That's a tragic reality that exists today.
And it's deep, it's serious, and it's wrong what's going on.
So we cannot allow this to be inevitable or to be the expectation that we set for our kids.
The children who are sitting in those classrooms afraid and in terror could care less about whether we are Democrats or Republicans.
We have accepted the unacceptable for too long.
And we're gonna stand up. And we're gonna fight.
Insist, demand, use the strongest possible terms.
Push and push and push
with every fiber in our being,
with the urgency and the solutions.
So the parents and teachers and kids don't have to worry about this.
The time has now come.
Doing nothing is not acceptable.
It is time for action.
We have to act in a bold way.
Save thousands of lives.
This will be a moment of determination. Determination to change.
Okay, so
problem solved, guys.
I think so. Well, look, they're trying to like have a like a front, you know, like against this thing. Oh, by the way, because I know people are gonna be like, well, why isn't my favorite candidate in that video? According to the Giffords organization, they invited all the candidates. Those are the ones that are in it. I'm sure it's schedule and stuff like that, but they were all invited supposedly. Don't at me. Chill. But anyway, look, since the last Congress was last in session. Back on August 2nd, there have been at least three mass shootings under one definition that have killed 38 people and injured many more. Okay, so with that context, everybody's saying something is going to happen. Emma Vigeland, is anything going to happen?
It's hard to be not cynical about that. And I'm happy that all of those candidates participated, but did we not realize that all of the candidates are united and wanting to change and want gun control on the Democratic side? Why are we pretending like it's otherwise? Every Democrat, except with the exception of like Dan Lipinski, wants gun control, right?
We have maybe Henry Cuellar.
Okay, maybe, right. We have a united front on this issue. Mitch McConnell and Trump are the problems here. And Mitch McConnell says, I'm not going to act unless Donald Trump gives the approval for the exact kind of gun control bill I will put through the Senate, which means you don't really understand what the Constitution is, Mitch McConnell, because the legislature is supposed to come up with the laws and then the president signs off on them. But he's such a bootlicker that this is the route that he's decided to go down.
And by the way, so I'm gonna sketch out a scenario that will never happen. Like I will sprout fairy wings and fly off before this actually happens. But think about how strong of a signal it would be to the country, to their constituents, that they care about this. If Mitch McConnell was like, look, I'm not gonna ban the assault weapons, you know, I'm not gonna confiscate guns, but we need full background checks. We're gonna do that. We're gonna send it to Trump, and when he vetoes it because he's, you know, under the boot of the NRA and he's, you know, a little whiny baby when it comes to that, we're gonna override his veto because we definitely have the votes to do that on milquetoast gun control legislation. He would never do that. But they could do it.
They could
get 66 votes.
But that would require him having a semblance of courage, and also the fact that the Republican voters who are going to probably vote him through again in 2020 love Trump. Mm-hmm. So Trump is popular in Kentucky. Mitch McConnell is the senator from Kentucky. That's why Amy McGrath, the Democrat who's in a, she's not yet won the nomination to take on Mitch McConnell, but why she's saying that she's a pro-Trump Democrat. He's very popular in Kentucky.
She said that she's a pro-Trump Democrat.
Oh, well, no, she's like, basically, the overall philosophy was that Mitch McConnell is the reason Trump isn't able to drain the swamp, mm-hmm. and that's why he's the one getting in the way of what Trump wants to do. And if you put me in office, yeah, it's a great strategy. It's a great strategy. I know. It hurts. I'll show you the video after this.
Is she the candidate that someone asked for a platform and she's like, I'll get back to you on that?
Yep.
Oh, Mitch McConnell's gonna be there for 100 more years.
I know, but there is I'm forgetting the name of it, but there is a radio host who's actually like primarying him to, or he's in the Democratic primary, so let's root for him.
And by the way, let's just take note of how perfect it is in a sick way that when the threat is more Americans being gunned down, more kids in particular being gunned down, the person stopping them from being protected likes to think of himself as the Grim Reaper. That's sort of perfect, isn't it? Now, supposedly, according to Republican sources close to McConnell, he sees a political benefit to moving a bipartisan measure in response to a spate of mass shootings this year. And he acknowledged the politics surrounding expanded background checks have shifted in recent months. They were hurt in suburbs, in 2018. So supposedly, maybe something will happen. Well, Donald Trump doesn't seem to want any change to background checks. Let's also know what a just amoral, cowardly thing to say. You know, we could do these background checks and stop. Like the last mass shooting was literally a result of a flaw, a loophole in the background checks. I see a political benefit to that. Not a moral benefit, a benefit to protecting American lives. I see a political benefit in the suburbs in the next election.
Fitting for the Grim Reaper.
Exactly. So I assume we're sort of agreed that we don't have high hopes at this point.
Are you kidding me? We work in this industry. How could we have high hopes?
Exactly. Yeah, it's sad because I agree with all of those faces you saw in that video. It is time for action. And that action is getting Mitch McConnell and other Republicans out of office so we can actually do something about this and other challenges. Anyway, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, Fox News versus Donald Trump. Look who's instigating now after this. For the last month or so, we've been covering this brewing war between Donald Trump and the state propaganda wing of his government. That would be Fox News. And apparently there was more going on behind the scenes that we actually knew. Let me catch you up and then we'll show what he's been doing behind the scenes to try to get them in line. So it sort of started, at least publicly, back at 10 a.m. August 28th when he lashed out at Fox News for, quote, heavily promoting Democrats. His response to a segment that featured the Democratic National Committee's communications director. He took to Twitter again a few minutes later, accusing Fox of, quote, letting millions of great Americans down. And look, there were many, many tweets that followed that, attacking Fox News in general, implying that his followers should watch some other network, attacking individual hosts. That was all public. Behind the scenes, though, on occasions when he's unhappy with the network's coverage, he picks up the phone and calls Fox News CEO Suzanne Scott to complain. A Trump administration aide and a second Fox News employee told The Atlantic. The conversations apparently don't go well for him, though, because again, behind the scenes, he's had all of these outbursts, these hissy fits, and supposedly, at least from inside sources in Fox News, they don't really care. And they think that in this relationship, they actually have the leverage. He definitely thinks he does. He thinks that if he wants to,
Shocker.
He can take his base and he can send him to OAN or whatever. But Fox thinks that they actually have a better hold on his voters than he does.
Well,
what do you think about that?
He wants it to be Trump TV. He mm-hmm. wanted to do Trump TV. He never thought he was going to win the election, that he was going to have his own media empire and that it would all just be Trump. And he doesn't realize that this is an organization that, while it is largely licking the boot of Donald Trump, mm-hmm. sometimes it strays just a tad from the exact kind of coverage that he may want. He can't fathom that. Mm-hmm. And I like how that Atlantic article went 10 a.m. August 28th. It began, like, hence known
it's
as
like
F Day.
60 minutes or something.
Yeah, yeah. Fox, like, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
the bomb was dropped on Twitter.
Yeah,
yeah, that is true. My advice to him would be just don't watch Shep Smith, man. I know that there are Twitter accounts that if I go to it, I'll be enraged. So yeah. I don't. Don't watch Shep Smith, okay? Or
maybe,
Chris Wallace, maybe.
Why are you giving him that advice? Because perhaps it will penetrate his teeny brain.
I doubt it.
I know, we're fighting a losing battle here.
I'm not convinced he watches the show, but we'll see. So let me give you a little more information. Suzanne Scott says, or an associate of Suzanne Scott says, they're not afraid of One America News. They know there's nowhere else for their audience to go. I've watched a little bit of One America News. It's like if like a sketch comedy group in a high school made a parody of Fox News, they'd have One America News. It is so pathetic and amateurish.
And the entire Fox News audience is 65 plus, and mm-hmm. so they don't even know how to change the channel on their fancy new remote at this point. So it's stuck there permanently. The audience isn't going anywhere, Donald Trump. So you can cry about it all you want, but they're also incentivized not to be intensely critical of him too, because that's what their audience wants. So it's a symbiotic, parasitic relationship, or no, I'm mixing them up. It's a symbiotic relationship.
There's a lot of little creatures eating the flesh of both of them.
Right, right. Who's the whale, though? Trump or Fox News?
I don't want to fat shame, but Trump in that particular case. So look, one of the interesting developments here I noticed on Twitter, a friend of the show, Jordan Yule, he had a little bit of video from Trump's rally last night. And it seems like this feud, some of Trump's fans are actually looking to stoke it a little bit further. Take a look at this video. So that is a Trump fan just yelling at him like, hey, talk about Fox News, boss man. It's like at like a Brian Regan show, people are yelling out, the yellow one is the sun, like trying to get him to do his best hits or something.
No one gets that reference.
No one, Brian Regan is a famous comedian. No?
All right, well, fine.
He's very good, you should listen to it.
Okay.
Anyway, I saw him in person, it was great.
But I really like how it just it gets louder and louder every time. Hey, mm-hmm. Fox News, hey, Fox News, and then it's just, we love you.
Yeah.
Also, yeah, was he trying to address Fox News in the media pit, or was he trying to get Donald Trump
I think he was trying to get Donald Trump to talk about it, which is possible. Like, his mind is Swiss cheese, he can be diverted. So because we're talking about Trump fans, I'm actually curious, you've had far more conversation with them in their element, in their natural domain, which is a Trump rally, than I have. What about Fox News and Trump? Like, they like both. If it came down to it.
Oh, you know the answer already. It's Trump, because they
so what do they do for news?
I mean,
just Twitter, Trump?
Yeah, Alex Jones. You can go into internet wormholes. There are even some on the progressive side or on the leftist side that we've talked about, where they just tell you what you want to hear. Mm-hmm. And there's plenty of that when it comes to Donald Trump online. And don't worry, he will always have Sean Hannity in his corner, who's going to say and do whatever he said, who addressed supporters at that rally. The crossover was very much complete at that point.
Yeah.
So there will always be at least one voice on Fox News who will be entirely sycophantic and in favor of whatever Donald Trump does. So don't worry, Trump fans, you'll always have a home at Fox.
Yeah, and look, Laura Ingraham, obviously. I would say Tucker Carlson too. I know that he tries to delude people with his fake populism and pretending that he gives a damn about wars abroad when he will support literally every Republican president for the rest of his life. But there's a lot of hours that are solid pro-Trump. So anyway, we'll see. We'll see if Boss Man does attack them again in the future. It'll be interesting to see once we get closer to the election if there are more in his pocket at that point. As always, thank you so much for talking with us this time in person.
I know, it's always way more smooth. It's way smoother, right?
Exactly.
That's the correct grammar. There.
Where can people see more of your work?
YouTube.com/RebelHU, Facebook.com/RebelHU.
And on Twitter as well.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for everybody for watching. She's also going to be here on Friday as well. We got a lot planned for the week. So we'll see you then.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.